From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and there are just 47 days left until Election Day. The first presidential debate is on Monday. And today, anger from the Trump campaign about the latest reporting from the Washington Post reporter David Farenthold, who says Trump used money from his foundation to settle lawsuits for his for-profit businesses. The foundation is funded almost entirely by other people's money. Here's Trump campaign manager Kellyanne Conway talking with CNN's Aaron Burnett.
There are many lawsuits every day against people. I think that's a bridge too far. I think you're making things up based on facts as they are not reported in this story.
Well, joining us now is NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Good afternoon.
And we spoke with David Farenthold just the other day about the reporting he's been doing. He's been reporting on this subject for a while. But remind us briefly of what is alleged here about the Trump Foundation.
Well, essentially, what David Farenthold has reported in this new reporting is that together he used about $258,000 from his charity, from his foundation, to settle some lawsuits that benefited his businesses. That's the rough breakdown of it. He essentially cut two checks from the foundation. One stemmed from like a flagpole that was built too high at Mar-a-Lago and had to settle with Palm Beach City in Florida. And they agreed to waive fines against him if he donated $100,000 to a veterans charity. But Donald Trump has not contributed any money to his own foundation since at least 2008. So he's essentially using other people's money to then settle something that would benefit his businesses.
Which is also not legal, correct? It's called self-dealing.
Well, and, you know, we haven't seen if anybody brings up any investigation into this yet. You know, the New York Attorney General has been on the case in other parts of the foundation reporting, but this reporting is pretty new. So we'll see where this winds up going, or if the IRS asks, pushes back against Trump as they have with, for example, the Pam Bondi case where they donated some money to her and then her investigation into Trump University was dropped.
Meanwhile, Domenico, the Clinton Global Initiative is closing its annual meeting today in Manhattan. Bill Clinton is there and said yesterday it would be the final meeting for the initiative should Hillary Clinton win the presidency. But a lot of people also looking at that and saying, why is this going on now, given how close we are to the election, how much criticism there's been of the Clinton Foundation? Why is he holding this big Clinton Global Initiative this year in New York?
Well, it's something that Bill Clinton holds every year in conjunction with the UN General Assembly, which is also going on. And he's pushed back on this and said that he doesn't find the charges or allegations to be founded and that he doesn't want to be reactive where he's, you know, because if he were to cancel it, then people would say, see, he's admitting something wrong. Plus, we should also point out it was this week 4 years ago that Mitt Romney went and spoke before CGI when Mitt Romney was the Republican nominee for president and said that one of the best things that can happen to any cause, to any people, is to have Bill Clinton as their advocate, especially for needy and neglected causes. So it's not like CGI was always a bad thing when it came to Republicans. It just so happens it happens to be that way this time around.
So as we mentioned, the first presidential debate is on Monday. Can't believe it's coming up so soon. And earlier this week, Trump accused the moderator, Lester Holt, of NBC of being a Democrat. It turns out he is a registered Republican. What do you make of that? And what are you expecting from Holt on Monday?
Well, Lester is a good man. He's a professional. He'll do a fine job, I'm sure. And Trump here is really just trying to work the refs. He said far more about other moderators of these debates as well. And that's to be expected from Donald Trump. But I have tremendous confidence in Lester Holt's ability and judgment.
Meanwhile, you have been looking at the polls all across the country. You published an updated battleground map this week on NPR's website based on polling for the presidential race. It looks like Trump does have a better path to winning than he did a month ago.
He certainly does. I mean, if you were to look last month, it was like road closed signs were up on every potential path that Donald Trump could go down. Now, there is at least one in which he could get to 270. It's still a very, very narrow path. He's leading now or tied in a host of eye popping places like Florida, Ohio, Iowa and Nevada. It's still not enough. He could take, though, a state like New Hampshire and North Carolina, where he's tied or slightly behind. That would get us to a 269-269 tie. And if he could pick up one more delegate out of our electoral vote out of Maine, which splits out its electoral votes, then he would win a very close 270-268. That's the path right now, but Clinton still leads.
This is why you all have to watch Veep, because they've played this out. NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro, thank you.
Thanks. Or look at the NPR Battleground map.
Well, at the United Nations General Assembly in New York today, leaders from around the world are gathering to talk about the growing threat from antimicrobial resistance. It's only the fourth time in 70 years that the General Assembly has hosted a meeting like this on global health issues. Helen Branswell covers infectious diseases for our partners at STAT. And Helen, first of all, how significant is today's meeting?
Well, it's huge. It signals that the people who've been shouting about this problem for years have finally made it through to the highest levels around the world, that this is a really huge problem and can't be ignored.
I see. Now, the other times that the General Assembly has hosted a meeting like this were about, you know, major global health issues such as AIDS and Ebola. But those diseases had reached something of a crisis point when the UN addressed them. I mean, are we at a crisis point with antimicrobial resistance?
Somebody today described it as kind of a slow-moving tsunami, which is a nice analogy. It's a problem that needs to be addressed. It's going to be difficult and complicated and require a lot of people at the table, and it really, they aren't starting a moment too soon.
Hmm. Now, you've written that antimicrobial resistance and superbugs could perhaps be one of the biggest health threats the world faces. So tell us more about why.
Well, when you think about what's happened in modern medicine, you know, there have been so many miracles. People don't necessarily die from cancer or certain types of cancers because we have chemotherapy. People get hip replacements and knee replacements. Babies are born safely. There are all sorts of medical procedures that rely on antibiotics to be safe to do. If you start thinking about what happens when those drugs no longer work, when the bugs aren't vulnerable to those drugs, you start to realize that things that we take for granted could come off the table. It may simply become, at a point, too dangerous to replace a hip or do open heart surgery or have a cesarean section to deliver a breech baby. I mean, there are lots and lots of circumstances that you could envisage in which things we take for granted now will just be extremely dangerous to do if more and more superbugs emerge.
Wow. So the fear of the secondary infection from antimicrobial resistant pathogens could, I mean, what you're describing is could in effect, it feels like almost turn back the clock on medical progress.
Exactly.
Wow.
And on longevity and economic development. I mean, it really has the potential to change the world.
Okay. So a sobering thought there. So given that, what is the focus and the goal of today's meeting at the UN?
The goal is to get all the parties around the table. I mean, in the human health sector, people have recognized this has been a problem for a while. And even though they've recognized it's been a problem, it's still hard to change human behavior. People still go to doctors and ask for antibiotics for colds and things that are probably caused by viruses that aren't affected by antibiotics. But some of the bigger problems involve the use of these drugs in agriculture. You know, they're used as growth promoters to produce food animals and farmed fish, and they're used in huge numbers in those sectors. In fact, the Pew Trusts say that about 70% of medically important antibiotics used in the U.S. are used in the agriculture setting as opposed to the human health setting. So you have to have those people at the table, too. You have to have agriculture ministers and economic ministers, people who understand that if everybody doesn't start pulling on the oars and going in the same direction, that this isn't going to get tackled.
Huh. Interesting. So are there other potential solutions or courses of action that are likely to be discussed at today's meeting?
There are a whole bunch of things. You know, tackling this is going to require a lot of different tools to be adopted. You know, the need to educate the public about how important this issue is and how they have a role to play in the judicious use of antibiotics. Improving sanitation and hygiene around the world, preventing infections. Yesterday, during a forum on this subject, somebody from Merck was talking about the fact that they want to pivot their agricultural antibiotic business over towards developing vaccines for animals so that you don't have to use as many antibiotics in agriculture production because the animals aren't going to be getting as sick as often. So development of vaccines would go an enormous way. Another thing is people are talking about the need to develop rapid diagnostic tests so people know what they're looking at when people or animals get sick and you know, okay, this is a viral illness, let's not use antibiotics, or this is a bacterial illness, but it doesn't require a broad spectrum antibiotic. We can use something that is more narrowly focused here. These are all part of the approach to getting this thing under control.
Well, Helen Branswell covers infectious diseases and public health for our partners at STAT. Helen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Today in the U.S., having HIV no longer means certain death. But even as treatments advance, there still isn't an outright cure. So of the many implications that has, one of them is that HIV-positive patients in need of organ transplants still need those transplants. And until 2013, those organs could only come from HIV-negative donors, at least in the United States. The HIV Organ Policy Equity Act was signed by President Obama, and that changed that reality. In March of this year, the first American HIV-positive to HIV-positive organ transplant was completed at Johns Hopkins University, and more have followed. For more on this, we're joined now by Matt Terrell. He's author of the Vice article, HIV-positive organ donors are now able to save lives. And Matt, to start with, how did doctors even know that this was possible?
HIV-positive to HIV-positive transplants is a fairly new field, but for several years there have been HIV-negative organs transplanted into HIV-positive patients, with doctors in California, New York, and even here in Atlanta doing these types of transplants. And what they found is that, yes, actually, people who are HIV positive can receive organs quite well. They do have rejection rate, which is 2 to 3 times higher than the rejection rate of HIV negative transplant recipients. Now, at first, that sounds quite scary because the idea of transplant rejection seems like something that you don't want. But for people who are HIV positive, that actually signals the fact that their immune system is active and working. And so this understanding of how to transplant HIV negative organs into HIV positive patients and how to treat them has helped pioneer the field of positive to positive organ transplants.
Mm. Now, what are the continued legal concerns or legal issues here in this country?
So what's really interesting is that the HOPE Act is a national level legislation that makes it legal to transplant positive tissue into other HIV positive patients. However, there are still 15 states across the country with criminalization laws for HIV that would make it a felony to transplant any sort of HIV positive tissue. This includes states like North and South Carolina, Florida, and even Georgia has a sort of HIV criminalization law that's about if you perform this type of surgery without notification. So there's layers of what is legally allowed in these states. Even though we have the national level legislation that makes it okay, transplant centers are very risk averse and you would not want to go against state law even if you have federal law on your side. So just this past year, University of California San Francisco Medical Center, their physician, Dr. Peter Stock, had to work with Governor Jerry Brown for last-minute legislation to overturn California's HIV criminalization laws in order to provide a transplant for an HIV-positive patient. They were transferring HIV-positive tissue into this HIV-positive patient, and they had a very small window of time to do it. And they had to work with their state to make it legal even to do this procedure.
Okay. Well, we're going to speak to a doctor in just a moment, but you obviously spoke with physicians and a patient for your story. What were their biggest hopes and concerns as perhaps this form of organ donation becomes more widespread?
I think the biggest hope is that people will realize that, yes, everybody deserves life. Even people who are HIV positive deserve the chance to receive a organ transplant. And so I think that first we need to make sure that people who are HIV positive know that they can donate organs. There is still some stigma surrounding the issue. For people who are HIV positive, the patient that I spoke with in New York who is HIV positive, who had received an HIV positive kidney, she said that she would have been very hesitant to have taken an organ from a living donor. and that she was happy that her kidney had come from a deceased donor. There's also the issue of comorbidities, and I'm sure you'll talk about this with Dr. Florman, but UCSF Medical Center found that patients who were also who had hepatitis C and were HIV positive and received organ transplants did not fare so well. So you have to deal with these other comorbidities first sometimes.
Well, Matt Terrell wrote the piece for Vice about HIV positive organ transplants. Matt, thanks so much.
Thank you. And I would like to encourage everybody to sign up to be an organ donor. You can go to registerme.org.
Well, let's turn now to Dr. Sandra Florman. He's director of the Recanati Miller Transplant Institute at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York, one of only two programs in the U.S. that has done one of these transplants. And Dr. Florman, welcome. But first of all, how does this kind of transplant differ from a typical transplant in terms of medical concerns? We just heard Matt Terrell talk about comorbidities. That's where patients suffering from HIV often have other diseases as well.
Right. So remember, these are people with HIV who have controlled disease. They have, by our protocol, undetectable viral load. They've never had the bad opportunistic infections. And they should, in fact, live as long as you and I on the antiretroviral therapy. But they have things that all of us get, like hypertension, diabetes. They get kidney failure. They get liver failure from things like hepatitis C. And they need transplants. So whether or not they get an organ from somebody who is HIV positive or not, they still have the same risk for transplant going forward. And there are greater comorbidities if you have HIV. Actually, a lot of the diseases are more progressive in that population.
And forgive me if this sounds like kind of a pedestrian question, but the medical science here is really fascinating to me because people who are suffering from HIV, as you said, the recipients already have to have a low viral load. So it's being controlled by various medications. But in a normal organ transplant, folks often almost always have to get some immunosuppressing drugs so that organ rejection doesn't happen. How do you handle that in a patient with HIV?
Oh. You are right on target. And so, look, this was a big fear in the transplant community for years, the idea that somebody with immunodeficiency, right, HIV, would then get anti-rejection medicines, which lower the immune system to prevent rejection. We thought that they would all become AIDS victims. But it turned out that some people were transplanted probably accidentally with HIV. Either the test before they got transplanted was a false negative, or maybe they even got it afterwards. And they actually did well. And people said, hey, wait a minute. What's going on there? And the answer is that HIV is not actually immune deficiency. Really, it's more immune dysregulation. It's a fascinating area of study because it turns out that many of the transplant medications actually work synergistically with the anti-HIV drugs. Some of them inhibit viral packaging. Some of that limit the ability of HIV virus to replicate. I mean, it really is remarkable.
I see. So in terms of the long wait list across the country for organ donations, what difference will it make now that these HIV-positive to HIV-positive transplants are possible?
Well, for those that are willing to accept it, and in our experience, everybody has been willing that we've talked to so far. We've consented over 70 HIV-positive patients on our list. They just got the equivalent of a lottery ticket. Remember, there are about 100,000 people waiting for a kidney transplant in the United States, and the average wait, depending on your blood type, can be anywhere from 5 to 7 years in a place like New York. Now, those people will all have access if they consent to taking an HIV-positive organ, and nobody else who's HIV-negative can have that. So essentially, their wait turns from years into potentially months.
And then also, they're no longer on the general organ transplant wait list.
Terrific point, and that's really important, is not only does it help the person with HIV, but it helps everybody because now that they're off the list, you have a better chance if you can't take one of those organs.
Okay. Now, based on what you said, I can only imagine that the reaction amongst patients that your institute has served has just been overwhelming.
Well, it is. I mean, look, there's a little bit of fear and trepidation. There are some theoretical risks. We don't know enough about all the details. The question is, could one strain of the virus overtake another? It's a theoretical risk. All of the data suggests that this won't happen in the way that we're selecting these donors. But that's why we're going to study this in an NIH-sponsored study. And that's why actually the Secretary of Health of the United States has decreed that this has to be done within a research protocol. But yes, I think they're ecstatic. And the five people we've done got transplanted way ahead of schedule. And that actually can be life-saving, right? Because the risk of dying if you're on dialysis is about 50% at 3 or 4 years.
Mm. Now, just to be clear, the transplants that have been done so far, the donor was deceased.
Good question. Yes, these are deceased donors, but the law does make it legal to procure these organs from living donors, and this is a very controversial area. The prevalence of HIV kidney disease, particularly in the African-American population, is very, very high. So we're worried that we could take somebody who appears with HIV to be perfectly well-controlled, a good donor, but put them at greater risk than they should be put.
In the conversation we had just before you with the reporter from Vice, he mentioned that one of the major challenges that stands in the way of these procedures being more common across the country is that while there may be a federal law making these transplants legal, there's quite a patchwork of state laws. And so not everyone in every state may have an opportunity who wants this kind of transplant to get it.
I suspect that that'll get resolved very quickly. I think the bigger issue is that there's still a lot of stigma about HIV among the practitioners, the surgeons, the nurses, among the organ procurement agencies, among everybody, right? And so it turns out that even though for people like me this makes perfect sense, there actually are very few programs in the country that transplant people with HIV.
Do you hope that it will become more prevalent?
Well, this would be the potentially largest increase to the deceased donor pool ever. There may be as many as 2,000, it's estimated, HIV-positive potential eligible donors, people who die or are brain dead and could potentially donate their kidneys. That's an enormous increase to the donor pool. You know, we have in the United States for all organs, we have over 120,000 people waiting for a transplant. I mean, this is a real crisis.
Well, Dr. Sandra Florman is the director of the Rocconati Miller Transplant Institute at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you.
While many Americans continue to look for jobs, around 3 million people are now quitting jobs each month, according to the Department of Labor. That's seen as a good sign for the larger economy because people choose to quit often when they've found a better job elsewhere. But how are they quitting? Kurt Nickisch is senior editor at Harvard Business Review, which has been looking into that. Kurt, what'd you find?
Yeah, so researchers at the University of Oklahoma and Oregon State University interviewed a whole bunch of people who quit their jobs, managers too, and they found that there are 7 different resignation styles, ranging from bridge burning all the way up to going by the book, staying on, giving plenty of notice, training your replacement. Hmm. But there's all these different ways in between the perfunctory goodbye, the avoidant resignation, the grateful goodbye. Those are all different ways that people go. And it turns out a big motivation in the different styles they choose to resign has to do with whether or not they feel like they want to get even with the company because it's their last chance.
And as you look at what happens next, I wonder which way of resigning is best for the company, which way is best for the employee?
Yeah, well, certainly the best for the company is by the book where, you know, you train
your
manager first. Exactly, right.
Give them a lot of help.
Because it costs a lot to replace workers.
Right.
And so this new research really gives companies tools to look and see how are people leaving? Why are they choosing these different ways to say goodbye? And what can they do to change that so that it doesn't cost them as much?
And I imagine that even if it might feel like the best for the employee, the bridge burning option is usually not the right idea.
Yeah, we know that's not the right idea, right? Because you may want to work there again someday.
Or maybe they will know somebody at another place that you want to work.
Yeah, exactly. But a lot of these in-between ones where, for instance, if you tell HR that you're leaving, you give notice, you kind of go by the book, but you actually let word filter back to your manager, that's also a little bit of a bridge burning. So, there's a big scale here, and companies want to move employees up to the right way to do it.
Well, Kurt, while we have you here, I know that Harvard Business Review has also been looking into another issue that some people have, which is they get a lot of requests for networking or career advice. Now, it may be an enviable problem to have, but also something that can take up a lot of time.
Yeah, if you said yes to every request – you know, for someone, can I buy you a coffee? Can I pick your brain? You might lose a lot of time that isn't productive for you or for the person that you're trying to help. So sometimes you get requests. You definitely want to say yes to them. You definitely want to say no to them. You realize it's not going to help. But there's this big gray area. And so we've published an article that lists a couple of strategies for handling gray area requests like this.
And what are they?
So first, you can just ask for more information. You'll find that if you just say, look, I'd love to see if I can be helpful, but can you tell me what you want to discuss and how I can be helpful to you in particular? You'll actually find that a lot of people don't even write back because maybe they don't even know. But if you get responses to that, you can always share resources. You can say, you know, here's something I wrote about online about that. Here's this other resource that you might want to check out. See if those answer your questions. If not, I'd love to be of help. And you'll find that most of the people don't follow up after that.
Well, we will link to more about this at hereandnow.org. Kurt Nickisch, senior editor at Harvard Business Review. Thanks so much, as always.
Oh, my pleasure.
World leaders are meeting this week in New York, discussing, among other things, the war in Syria, which has produced nearly 5 million refugees and internally displaced millions more. In the U.S., 10,000 Syrian refugees were accepted this year, with Texas among the states receiving the most, even though some in the state have tried to block the refugees from coming. One of those refugees is Bassam al-Abbas, who is married with three children. They left their home in Syria in 2012 and arrived in the U.S. in May. They're now living in the Austin area. We'll be speaking with him through an interpreter, Katan Mustafa, of the Refugee Services of Texas. Bassam, welcome.
Marhaban bik, Bassam.
Ahlo sahla.
Thank you so much.
And let me ask you, Bassam, you've been in the U.S. since May. How difficult was it for you to get here?
أنت كنت في أوستن أو جيت لي أوستن في شهر الخامس. كيف كانت حياتك؟ هل هي تكلمنا عن الصعوبات اللي واجهتها؟
طبعا أول ما بيصل الواحد يعني بيكون ما عنده لغة. اللغة صعبة طبعا الواحد ما عنده لغة صعب إنه يتعامل مع اللي حواليه.
When I first arrived in May, my first difficulty was the language. I wasn't able to speak the language that the most people here speak.
Have you been learning English?
بديت تتعلم اللغة الإنجليزية؟
طبعا.
Yes, of course, I started.
And how much vetting did you have to go through in order to be processed and allowed to come into the United States?
كم من الإجراءات الأمنية أنت دخلت عليها قبل ما خلوك تدخل أمريكا؟
أنا ضليت أعمل مقابلات حوالي السنة وثمان أشهر.
The interviews for the vetting took me 1 year and 8 months.
Wow. And have you been able to find work?
هل استطعت الحصول على عمل هنا في أوستن؟
طبعاً.
Yes, of course.
What are you doing?
شوف شغلك.
مجال البناء.
I'm working in construction.
And what about your family? Are your children going to school here?
وكيف عائلتك هنا؟ الأطفال بيروحوا للمدرسة؟
بالمدرسة.
Yes, my kids go to school.
Well, tell us about how your experience has been and how your family's experience has been. What do you think of the United States?
ممكن تتكلم لنا عن تجربتك تجربة عائلتك شنو اللي ظن عن أمريكا أو حياتك في أمريكا؟
يعني من أول ما اجتني السفرة أنا كنت ناظر المنظور منظور عقد عمل جاني عقد عمل على أمريكا فاجيت لهون وشفت الاستقبال طبعا بالمطار.
When I first came or I knew I'm going to America, I thought it's like this is a work contract. So I was thinking, I was like, I'm going there to work. And then when I arrived at the airport, a lot of people welcomed me.
وكانت فرصة دراسة لأطفالي كمان يعني كنت عم بفكر مستقبل أطفالي إنه فرصة دراسة يعني.
And I was thinking about like the future of my kids, and I think my kids will have really good education opportunity.
وصلنا واستقبلتنا المنظمة اللي هي الـ RST.
When I arrived, the RST organization welcomed me.
ومشينا بالإجراءات القانونية، الأوراق والأمور الثانية، يعني كل الأوراق الرسمية.
And immediately I start to applying for my paperwork here that's required from me.
والأمور تمام الحمد لله، يعني الأطفال في المدرسة و... وأنا عندي وظيفة كويسة والأمور ماشية الحمد لله تمام.
Everything is okay. Thank God I have a job. My kids now in the school. Everything is going well with me.
And what about the neighbors there in Austin? Have people welcomed you?
ماذا عن الجيران بتاعك بمدينة أوستن؟ هل رحبوا فيك؟
كتير.
A lot.
لدرجة لا توصف، يعني يعني عطونا فكرة خلونا نحب البلد.
I cannot describe how much they welcomed me. They made us love this country.
Have you faced any people who don't want you there? We know that leaders in the state of Texas spent several months trying to keep Syrian refugees out of the state.
أقول هل أنت واجهت أي شخص ما مرحب بيك؟ أقول إحنا بنعرف إنه سياسيين في تكساس ما بيريدوا اللاجئين السوريين بيجوا لأوستن أو لتكساس.
لا لا، ما واجهت أي حدا من هذول الناس.
I haven't faced any negativity. I haven't faced any people who never welcomed me.
Well, what would you say to people who are scared of Syrian refugees coming into the U.S. and then some of them deciding to do harm to Americans?
شو أنت بتريد تقول للناس اللي في أمريكا اللي ما بيريدوا اللاجئين السوريين يجون لأن يظنون إنه اللاجئين السوريين راح يأذون هذا البلد؟ شو بدك بتقول لهم؟
إحنا بنقول لهم يعني إنه النظرة اللي أخذينها عنا أكيد هي نظرة غلط، وإذا في يعني إحنا اللي إجينا العيال اللي وصلت لهون، الناس اللي وصلت لأمريكا، أكيد إحنا راح نحاول إنه نغير هاي الصورة اللي أخذينها عنا، الصورة الغلط.
The people who think a negative way about Syrian refugees, I think this is a wrong thought from them. We are the Syrian refugees who are currently in America. We will work to make them switch these thoughts about us.
Have you kept in touch with people back in Syria? And what do you think could bring an end to the civil war there?
هل أنت عندك تواصل مع ناس في سوريا لحد الآن؟ وشنو تتصور أنه راح ينهي الحرب الأهلية في سوريا؟
والله يا ريت يعني أنا أهلي كلهم برات سوريا، ما إلي حدا في سوريا.
All my family have left Syria. I have no one stayed in Syria now.
Have they all come to the United States or they've gone to other places?
عائلتك اللي عافوا في سوريا جوي لليونايتد ستيت ولا راحوا خارج سوريا في بلد ثاني؟
لا، في بلد ثاني خارج سوريا.
They left Syria to a different country, but they are not here in US.
So do you think that the civil war can come to an end at any point, or what should be done?
أنت تتوقع أنه الحرب الأهلية راح تنتهي؟ شنو اللي راح يصير على أساس علشان تنتهي الحرب؟
والله بالنسبة لي أنا هاي المواضيع يعني ما عندي فكرة عنها، لأنه أنا نظرتي للحياة نظرة عمل ونظرة دراسة، يعني ما بحب أفكر بأي منطلق تاني أو أي منحنى تاني.
I don't like to think about like the civil war. My life is focused around work and school. I just don't like to think about the war.
Do you ever want to return to Syria?
ممكن أنت ترجع لسوريا في يوم من الأيام؟
هلا أكيد إنه الواحد بلده، يعني ما راح، بس يعني المهم عندي مستقبل أطفالي، حياتي مربوطة بمستقبل أطفالي.
سوريا is my country, but my life now is connected around my kids, and my kids' future is here.
So now that your kids are in the United States, what do they want to do with their future? What do they want to be when they grow up?
Okay, الآن أنت في الولايات المتحدة الأمريكية، شو أطفالك بدو بيكونوا من لما بيكبروا؟
لعندي ثلاث أطفال، الكبير بدو يصير مهندس طيران.
I have three kids. My oldest son wants to be an engineer, a plane engineer.
والثاني بده يكون مهندس الكترونيات كمبيوتر وبرمجيات.
Okay, my second son wanna be IT engineer.
وعندي الصغير مولع بالحيوانات بيحب انه بس يكبر يصير طبيب بيطري.
Okay, and my youngest one loves animals and he wanna be working in the medical field with animals.
Well, Bassam Al-Abbas, best of luck to you. Thank you so much for joining us, and give our best to your family as well.
You're welcome.
And Katan Mustafa, I want to thank you as well for doing a great job of translating for us. That's Katan Mustafa with the Refugee Services of Texas. Thank you to you.
Thank you so much.
The list of cities hoping to host the Summer Olympics in 2024 looks like it's about to get a bit smaller. Rome's newly elected mayor, Virginia Raggi, has rejected the city's bid to host the Olympics in 8 years. Raggi said it would be financially irresponsible to pursue the bid, especially for a city that sometimes fails to pick up the garbage. Raggi was elected in June. She's a lawyer with little political experience. The New York Times recently reported that her first few months in office have been challenging. And just recently, an Italian newspaper reported that about 70 city administrators had written a letter to the mayor complaining about paralysis and a lack of guidance. Rome's city assembly will now vote on Raggi's rejection, but Italy's premier said the bid would be doomed without the mayor's blessing. Voters in Hamburg, Germany rejected their city's bid for the 2024 Games. Boston pulled its bid too, so if Rome officially pulls itself out of the running, three cities, Los Angeles, Paris, and Budapest, Hungary, will be remaining. There's a sculpture with a secret message outside CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, and it's stumped amateur codebreakers for a quarter century. A software developer from Nashville, Tennessee, has spent the better part of two decades trying to unravel the mystery of cryptos. Tony Youngblood from Here and Now contributor Nashville Public Radio has her story.
Ilanka Dunin has a knack for cracking codes. She's so good that codebreaking competitions often disqualify her. One even left her a personal note in the rules sheet.
And at the bottom it said, give someone else a chance, Ilanka. And so I cracked that one too. They were a little upset, but yeah, what can you do? It's like, here it is, here's the solution.
When Dunin sets her mind to something, she's unstoppable. That drive led to jobs as an astronomer, an Air Force spy plane technician, and a trailblazing video game designer. And when it comes to cryptography, you could say she wrote the book, because she did. It's called The Mammoth Book of Secret Codes and Cryptograms. All this, and yet one goal has eluded her for 16 years, ever since she stumbled upon a picture on the CIA's website.
And I see this sculpture, Cryptos, and I'm like, okay, it's one of the most famous unsolved codes in the world. Ha, ha, ha. But it planted a seed in me of, that's interesting.
Cryptos was designed by artist Jim Sanborn in the late 1980s as a commission for CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia.
It's about 12 feet tall. It's about 20 feet long. Imagine a petrified log that has been stood on end.
The log connects to a curved copper sheet. It looks a little like a flag waving in the wind. Hundreds of letters are carved into the sheet so you can see through them. The text reads like gibberish, but it actually contains four secret messages. The first three were solved in the late 1990s. Here's Dunin reciting the solution to part one. It's a single sentence, the meaning of which is a mystery in itself.
Between subtle shading and the absence of light lies the nuance of illusion.
But the fourth message is the great unsolved mystery, and that has become a pop culture phenomenon. Books, movies, conspiracy theories all center on cryptos, like this scene in the TV show Alias.
In fact, as you can see, the sculpture is itself a code, apparently a very good one. To this day, no one has been able to decipher the message.
For Dunin, solving the fourth code became an obsession. She had to see Cryptos in person. In October 2001, she visited her cousin in Washington, D.C., and they took a little side trip to Langley. It didn't go well.
Guards come pouring out, asking, who are you and why are you here? We were saying, you know, like, hey, is there like a public tour day? Can we get an invitation from a congressperson? And no, the guards were very firm.
Dunin was discouraged, but she didn't give up. She started giving talks around the country on steganography. That's the practice of hiding secret messages inside images, videos, and sounds. This was shortly after 9/11, and Al-Qaeda was suspected of using this technique.
So in my talk, I put a couple slides with a picture of the crypto sculpture, and I used it as my example for what a picture looks like if you're hiding something inside of it. And I'd say, boy, I'd love to give this talk at CIA someday.
Several months later, she spoke at DEF CON, the world's largest hacker convention. After her talk, a stranger walked up to the podium.
And they leaned across and they looked me in the eye and they said, I work at Langley. I think I can get you in.
Just 1 year after her first visit, Doonan was back at the imposing gates with the intimidating guards. But this time, instead of turning her away, they waved her through. She walked to the courtyard next to the cafeteria, and there it was.
It was large. It was cold. I was just in this mode of trying to be hyper-observant and seeing everything I possibly could.
Doonan took pictures of Kryptos and made charcoal rubbings of the letters. When she got home, she posted them on her personal website.
Then I started getting messages, emails from all over the world, because now there was like this central Kryptos information repository. It just kind of grew and grew, and I found myself getting invited to different places to speak on Kryptos.
Today, Doonan is known as the Kryptos expert. She leads an online group with thousands of members dedicated to cracking the fourth code, called K4.
People ask me if I have to be the one to solve K4, and I say no. I just want to see it solved. If I can be the person that provides enough information that it becomes solved, that will be very satisfying for me.
Kryptos might never be solved, but if it is, Doonan says she'll breathe a sigh of relief and move on to the next mystery. For Here and Now, I'm Tony Youngblood.
You can learn about Kryptos at our website, hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.